In another Senate hearing yesterday, Mr. Obama's pick to head the Environmental Protection Agency, Lisa Jackson is her name, was asked about air pollution, toxic coal ash, and reversing some Bush administration policies. NPR's Elizabeth Shogren has this report.
Lisa Jackson used to head New Jersey's Department of Environmental Protection, so one of that state's senators, Robert Menendez, helped introduce her. He said she reminded him of a famous T-shirt.
It says, New Jersey, only the strong survive. Lisa Jackson has not only survived, but she has thrived in developing and implementing policies that have won wide-ranging praise and respect.
Jackson is a chemical engineer who spent 15 years at the Environmental Protection Agency earlier in her career. She would be the first African American to head the agency. Committee Chairwoman Barbara Boxer of California asked her to respond to last month's coal ash spill in Tennessee. Jackson replied by saying she wants to address the threat from huge piles of toxic coal ash stored at hundreds of other coal-fired power plants around the country.
I would think that EPA needs to first and foremost assess the current state of what's out there and where there might be another horrible accident waiting to happen.
Jackson said she'd also consider regulating coal ash, something the EPA has been studying for almost three decades. Boxer urged her to do so quickly or else.
If we are not satisfied with action, we may move legislatively.
Boxer and other senators also pressed Jackson to make good on Mr. Obama's pledge to grant California's request to set tough greenhouse gas standards for cars. The Bush administration turned California down. Jackson said decisions by the Supreme Court and other federal courts have laid the groundwork to start regulating greenhouse gases and do more to cut other air pollution.
All those things together mean that there will be an extraordinary burst of activity, not just at EPA, but I would expect potentially from Congress.
Delaware Senator Tom Carper summed up how busy Jackson will be with a comment to her husband, Kenneth.
I just want to say, take a good look at your wife. When you bring her home from the inaugural ball, take a real good look at it. That's the last time you'll see her at Christmas. Make sure your kids have plenty of pictures of her. Well, they'll see her on TV.
Elizabeth Shogren, NPR News, Washington.
It's not just the guns in Kabul that are dangerous. It's also the air. In the freezing winters, many residents in Afghanistan's mile-high capital burn plastic and tires for warmth. Those lucky enough to own a car use leaded fuel. And then there are thousands of gas-burning generators in shops and homes across the city to provide power that the government can't. Air pollution in Kabul is so bad that President Hamid Karzai has declared an emergency. NPR correspondent Soraya Sarhadi Nelson lives in Kabul and has this story.
Experts say Kabul is rapidly becoming one of the world's worst cities for air pollution. And nowhere is it more polluted than in this neighborhood near President Karzai's compound. Here, the rancid air casts a yellow haze. Pedestrians hurry past, pressing scarves to their faces. Several American Humvees roll past Mahbubullah Bakhtiari, who is setting up a cylindrical device. He works for Afghanistan's Environmental Protection Agency and is here to measure just how bad the air is.
We put filter in air.
Bakhtiari places white filters into the monitor.
And then we tight it. Now it's ready.
He says it will take less than a day for those filters to turn black.
Do you wear a mask yourself here, knowing how bad the air is?
No.
Why not?
Because if we wear masks, people will laugh on us.
They will laugh at you.
Yeah.
But he and others here say the smog is no laughing matter. Darullah Mansouri is the chief of staff at the Afghan EPA.
The air pollution that we are facing currently in Afghanistan in Kabul, if such pollution exists anywhere else in the world, there will be new schools open, new shops. No government agencies will be able to function because this is seventh time worse than the standards.
And the problem is growing. Experts say there are many reasons why, such as 5 million people living in a city designed for 500,000. Most of them burn wood, coal, and trash to keep warm during the cold winters. Raw sewage and dust add to the smog, as do factories that spew unfiltered smoke. There are also 10 times as many cars on the streets now than during the Taliban era. Most are foreign cast-offs that run on leaded fuel. The result of all this smog is seen in hospitals across Kabul. Doctors say residents flock to them with lung and heart ailments, as well as cancers. Muhammad Iqlil Niazi is a doctor at Ali Abad Hospital. He says 4 years ago, one in five patients had an ailment triggered by air pollution. Now he estimates one in three is sick from the smog. Like 55-year-old Muhammad Ismail, the frail shopkeeper who doesn't smoke suffers from a chronic lung disease his doctors say is caused by air pollution. He's come to the hospital for drugs to ease his cough. His doctors say the only real remedy is for him to leave Kabul. That's what Mansouri did. The Afghan EPA official moved to a nearby town. He says he'd rather risk attacks by militants during his commute to Kabul than let his kids breathe the air here. Yet few in the government besides Mansouri have paid attention to air pollution.
Something is definite that previously environment was not priority for this government. Security, defense, other issues were priority.
Mansouri's agency was given no teeth and little money when it was established 3 years ago. Even now, there are few environmental laws on the books, none of which are enforced because of rampant bribe-taking. At a recent cabinet meeting, President Karzai declared such inaction must end, and quickly. Mansouri, who was there, says Karzai authorized $100 million to buy equipment to reduce air pollution in Kabul. He formed an emergency committee with far-reaching powers to tackle the problem. Mansouri says the president also ordered that bushes be handed out to residents for planting to help absorb the toxins.
Now I think the cabinet members and the president himself, they came to know that if you don't have safe environment, clean environment, you never have safe economic development and sound social development.
But Mansouri says that doesn't change the fact it will take years to reduce smog here. Saraya Sarhadi Nelson, NPR News, Kabul.
NPR's Najib Sharifi contributed to that report.
Like thousands of fishing boats off America's shores, the infidel has giant nets that catch all kinds of sea creatures. But unlike most, the infidel is a ghost ship, a sunken wreck 150 feet below the surface. And for about 2 years now, the trawler's tangled nets have snared and killed sharks, dolphins, sea lions, and fish off Southern California's Santa Catalina Island. Now volunteer divers are taking on the dangerous work of removing those nets. Kurt Lieber is one of them. He's also head of the Ocean Defenders Alliance. It's a nonprofit devoted to cleaning up abandoned fishing gear. Mr. Lieber, thanks for being with us.
Well, nice to be here.
And you've been diving down to the infidel. Tell me what it's been like to try to cut away these nets.
Well, first of all, when you drop down on it, it's a very disturbing sight. It's a very eerie sight to see a very large trawler completely encased in a series of nets. Now, this is only one net, and it's a big billowing net. So when the ship sank, this net just was floated around the top of the mast and drapes down from there to the sand. Every time I go down there, it just feels like an open graveyard because you're seeing scattered bones and skulls all over the place.
How big is this net, and how do you go about trying to cut it away?
We estimated right now that it's 9,000 pounds. We were hoping to be able to take it away in one section, but that proved to be way out of whack. There's no way we're going to get it out in one cut. So we were just really systematically going around various parts of the hull, seeing what will come up easily, and then we take our cutting tools, which are knives and surgical shears, and cut around the area where we can free it. Obviously, this wreck has a lot of rigging on it, and the rigging is what's catching a lot of the net. So we place lift bags in various corners of the net, raise those lift bags up. We fill them with air, and it raises them up a little bit. And then we can see where we can cut and not snag anything.
What's the most dangerous part of all that?
Just what I described. The divers are putting those lift bags on this net, and as the lift bags go towards the surface, when the net gets cut free, if the diver is near that area and they get snagged on the net, and it's easy to do, that's when the diver can become, you know, entangled in it and be flown to the surface very fast, and that will cause the bends and possibly die.
Do you have a sense of how long it's going to take to get rid of this massive net down there?
I've been on these projects for quite a while, and they all take on their own life. I've removed an 800-pound net, which is one-tenth the size of this. And that 800-pound net took us 3 months because of weather conditions, and we're a nonprofit. We all have day jobs, so we can't go out during the week. But that one 800-pound net took us 7 dive days. Now, this net, I'd have to say it's going to be at least 15 dive days.
How big a problem are nets like this, do you think?
Well, there's been a study up in Washington where they analyzed a net that had been down for 10 years. They were doing a study on the amount of animals killed in that. And 30,000 animals died every year in that. Now, that's mammals as well as the fish and invertebrates. So when you compound that over the thousands of nets that are out there, it's a huge problem. All our fisheries are severely depleted. I can't think of one that's sustainable, even though the government will tell you there are a couple of them. But all of them are severely reduced. So anything we can do to minimize that impact on the fisheries is a big benefit.
And these are nets, I'm sure, that are designed to last an extremely long time.
That's the unfortunate part. These are made out of hemp, which deteriorates over time, but they're interwoven with polypropylene, and those will be down there for hundreds, if not thousands, of years.
Well, Mr. Lieber, thanks for talking with us. Appreciate it.
So do I. Thanks for the invite.
Kurt Lieber is the founder of the Ocean Defenders Alliance. He's one of the divers working to remove nets from the Infidel, which sank off the California coast. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. This is Day to Day. I'm Alex Cohen.
And I'm Madeline Brand from the North American International Auto Show in Detroit. It's where the car companies are unveiling their new designs, and there is a lot of talk about plug-in electric hybrids here. But we keep hearing 2010, 2011, before we can actually buy them. Except for one company you probably have never heard of. It's called Fisker Automotive. And that company's making me think the future of the car industry isn't necessarily here in Detroit. It's here in Irvine, California, 2,500 miles to the west of Detroit. And no, I didn't just transport myself here over the last few seconds. I came out here a few days before going out to Detroit to meet Henrik Fisker, the owner of Fisker Automotive, to ask him, really, here in this corporate office park, this is the future of the American car industry? So we are standing in front of a drawing table. You have some drawings here. What are they?
Well, these are some of the sketches for variations of the Karma plug-in hybrid car. Eventually, the Karma will actually spin off a family of vehicles. So it's not only going to be a four-door, as we showed today or yesterday, there will also be a convertible version, and later perhaps a more family-oriented version as well.
So you have, for a long time, been designing high-end luxury sports cars, and this is... See a high-end luxury sports car with a difference. How did you decide to get into electric and green technology?
Well, I think everybody can kind of see. I don't think it's a secret. I think everybody can see that where the world is going. And I think for me, when you start seeing movie stars driving around in a Toyota Prius instead of a Ferrari, you realize definitely something is changing. And I think, you know, I love sports cars and I love fast, beautiful cars. And what I've seen so far was they were always tiny cars, not always that attractive, and usually very slow. So I thought, if we're going to have a bright future for the automobile, we got to get back to why did we fall in love with the car. And that was because it looked good, it was because it was fast, it was exciting. And I wanted to bring those elements into an environmental vehicle, into a green car. So that's kind of where the idea came from. So this car is really designed from beginning as a plug-in hybrid.
How long does it take to charge?
every household has a 220 volt, a 240 volt, where the washer and dryer, if you convert that, it's only about 3.5-4 hours. So, you know, basically we expect most people will, just like when you come home with your mobile phone, you plug it in, you come home with your car, you plug it in. It's that simple. It goes into a normal plug.
So if it is that simple, why has it taken until now for this technology to be used and developed?
The automakers today, they have basically developed their cars in the same way for almost 100 years. And suddenly you're now telling them to change completely the way they think. And that's very hard because all the automakers are huge global companies, so you just don't change from one day to another. Whereas some of the new startup companies like us, we don't have any history. We don't have to sell a whole bunch of gasoline cars. You know, that's probably our advantage, that we've been able to assemble a team of automotive engineers from all over the world and put them in one location, and they're working almost with no limitations in terms of creativity, and get a vehicle together that really, I think, shows where the future is going if we still want to have exciting, fast cars.
We are in the midst of a global recession. Unemployment is very, very high. People are getting laid off left and right. Your car costs nearly $90,000. Is this the right time to be launching this car?
There's room for every segment. It's just like the restaurant business. There's always going to be room for somebody who wants to go in and have a filet steak. And there's going to be room for somebody who just wants a burger. And because the economy is bad, doesn't mean we all have to eat burgers. And I think there's still room enough. You see people are still buying Mercedeses and Lexuses. And why shouldn't we go in and take some of that market? A small company like us, I would say it's almost impossible for somebody in any startup to go out and suddenly serve the mass market, because you need huge factories, you need big assembly lines, billion-dollar investments. So before you get to that point, you have to start small, you have to create a brand, and you have to show that you can actually do a vehicle, and then you start moving down market and create a higher volume. And that's exactly our philosophy. We start out with a high-end vehicle, where we're going to show that we're able to do a beautiful, you know, high-quality car. We're going to get it on the market, and our next project will be a lower-cost car, but we'll probably not do a $20,000 car, but we'll move down market and higher in the volume.
Henrik Fisker, owner of Fisker Automotive, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
In Detroit, the press and the public are looking for the effects of last month's $17.4 billion bailout of the auto industry. Motor City is host to the North American International Auto Show this week and next. My colleague Madeline Brand is there, and she is looking into some of the new green automotive technology. We'll hear about that in just a few minutes. But first, we go for a ride in Shenzhen, China, with NPR's Anthony Kuhn.
This city in southern China is the home of a Chinese company called BYD, which stands for Build Your Dream. They've also built the world's first mass-produced plug-in hybrid car, beating both Chevrolet and Toyota to the punch. It's a mid-size sedan called the F3DM, and so I figured that if this is the wave of the future, then I had better get behind the wheel and check it out. Now here we go. We're going to turn the key. For advice on the hybrid drive, I turned to BYD marketing representative Jasmine Huang in the back seat.
If we drive at a high speed, the engine will work.
Okay, so over 60 kilometers an hour, then the gasoline engine kicks in. And below 60 kilometers, it's all on electricity. All right, now, the car has started, and we're going to put it in drive. And there's quite a bit of pep to it. It picks up nicely when we step on the electricity. We're just driving around the parking lot to see what it feels like. And as you can hear, the engine makes a little noise, but it's pretty quiet. The engine is quite responsive. The F3DM gets 160 to 180 horsepower and can go up to 60 miles just on its lithium-ion battery, after which it relies on its small gas engine. BYD claims that charging the F3's battery costs 75% less than filling up a gasoline-powered car. Unlike the Toyota Prius, you can charge the F3's battery from an ordinary wall socket. The problem is that it takes 9 hours. Henry Lee is in charge of BYD's automotive exports, and he says BYD is working with electricity companies to set up charging stations where motorists could charge a battery half full in 10 minutes.
It's a chicken and egg situation. Do you set up the charging stations first, or do you make the cars first? That's why we decided to make a plug-in hybrid car that is not reliant on charging stations, and when the battery runs out, you still have the gas engine.
Metallurgist Wang Chuanfu founded BYD in 1995 and quickly built it into one of the world's top producers of cell phone and laptop computer batteries. Wang impressed investor Warren Buffett. In September, one of Buffett's companies purchased a 10% stake in BYD for $230 million. Independent auto industry analyst Jia Xinguang explains how this might work.
Buffett has a company called MidAmerican Energy. They made the investment in BYD. They also have an electricity grid in the American Midwest, so that's the cooperation. BYD builds the cars, and MidAmerican Energy builds the charging stations.
MidAmerican Energy declined to be interviewed for this report. BYD is still a couple of years from rolling out their cars in the U.S. Henry Lee says his company is working hard on building their cars to suit American drivers' tastes.
BYD's Information Technology Division has been in business in the U.S. for 10 years. We understand Americans' concerns about safety and quality, so in designing this car for the U.S. market, we will certainly meet these requirements.
For now, BYD will focus on China's domestic market. Priced at about $22,000 each, the cars are a bit pricey for average consumers, so BYD will first aim at government and corporate buyers. Analyst Jia Xinguang says it will take time for the new technology to win acceptance. From an environmental standpoint, electric cars are not yet as green as they could be. That's because most electricity is generated by burning coal. But BYD is working on that too. They're in the early stages of researching electric cars powered by solar energy. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Shenzhen, China.
The nominee to run the Energy Department, Stephen Chu, will explain his plans for America's energy future when he goes before a Senate panel today. If confirmed, Mr. Chu's job will be simply to create a new, greener energy economy. Just that one simple thing, which happens to touch on every single thing we do in life. At least that's what the president-elect Barack Obama has been promising. NPR's Christopher Joyce has this look at what Stephen Chu may have in mind.
Stephen Chu, the physicist, is something of a rock star among scientists. He won science's most coveted award, the Nobel Prize, in 1997. Stephen Chu, the bureaucrat, is a green energy advocate. 4 years ago, Chu took over the Department of Energy's Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory in California. He bent his own career and the focus of the lab to the problem of making new fuels from green sources, things like grasses and agricultural waste. The reason, he says, is that fossil fuels, coal, oil, and natural gas, are warming the planet dangerously. Chu hasn't been saying much since his nomination, but in a conversation about a year ago with NPR reporters, Chu said he thinks Americans aren't really up to speed on the climate threat.
I don't think the American public understands a reasonably high probability some very bad things will happen. They fundamentally don't understand that, because if they really felt that, then they would do something about it.
But Chu says people shouldn't think of fighting climate change as a sacrifice.
The goal is not actually to say, okay, everybody use less energy, don't heat your homes, don't light your homes. The goal is to have a standard of living which is carbon neutral and works well with the world.
Carbon neutral means moving away from coal and other fuels that put a lot of carbon into the atmosphere. Chu says one way to do that is through the marketplace.
A price on carbon is one of the, if I had to name six things, that would certainly be one of them.
Chu says he's no fan of coal, and that could get him into some hot water among members of Congress who represent coal mining states, for example. Chu says coal will have to be used in a less polluting way. The coal industry says it could do that, but it's going to be expensive since coal provides about half the country's electricity. Many climate activists say coal's only hope is to go clean. Eileen Clawson runs the Pew Center on Global Climate Change, a climate think tank.
The notion that we would simply stop burning coal, I think, is a fantasy. So the issue is, how quickly can we make it into something that doesn't harm the climate? And I think he will be an advocate for that.
The Department of Energy may not be the best place to do that, however. While the DOE's research budget is among the largest in the federal government, most of DOE's money goes to building and maintaining the government's nuclear weapons and to cleaning up nuclear waste. The research and development budget has been pretty flat during the Bush administration. But Mr. Obama says he wants to change that and build a new green energy economy. Again, Eileen Clausen of the Pew Climate Center.
I think we're seeing a new Department of Energy. Because I think the focus is going to be on energy more than on nuclear weapons side of the house. I think the president-elect is committed to a new energy future, and I think he's going to look to DOE to do a lot of the technological work to make sure that that future is possible.
But no one expects this to happen fast.
There is built into the system a kind of inertia.
Ernest Moniz is a professor of physics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He was Undersecretary of Energy for President Bill Clinton. He says retooling the energy economy will affect the environment, agriculture, commerce, transportation, just about everything the government regulates.
And the Secretary of Energy is, frankly, not in a position to easily convene all of those interests. So energy policy really cries out for a White House coordinating function.
Which it will have. Mr. Obama has created a new climate and energy office in the White House. It's an office the new energy secretary is likely to be visiting quite often. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.